tonight. Appreciate everyone. If you want to go ahead and open up your Bible, we're going to open up to Daniel, the 6th chapter. And that's where we're going to begin this evening. And tonight I'm going to do something a little different than normal. I'm not going to have my normal 3 points. So I'm not going to be able to be like 1, 2, 3. But I'm going to tell you what I hope to accomplish this evening as we look into the Old Testament for a moment. In this month of November, it's often called a month of thanks, right? We got Thanksgiving that's coming up, and we're going to think about being thankful for things. And Michael, I think, is even going to be talking about that some later in the month. And so, Beth and I, we have this little saying between us. When things are not going well, specifically on days that it is really hot outside in the summer, she will text me and she will say, "Today I am thankful for air conditioning." Or I will be thankful for whatever the case may be. But oftentimes, we have to find gratitude and thankfulness when things aren't going so well. Because it's easy to be thankful when everything is clicking and everything is just the way it should be. It's easy to be thankful. Now, I might overlook that thankfulness and not give that back to God because life is so easy. But when it's difficult, I have to sometimes find a reason to be thankful for something, right? And I got to thinking about, well, who are Bible characters, specifically in the Old Testament, that would resemble that? Who would exemplify people who had a terrible circumstance, but yet they found a way to be really thankful? I would like to suggest that our friend Daniel was just that way. Many people that don't even know a lot about the Bible, they have probably heard about Daniel and the lion's den. And how there was this guy, he was thrown into the lion's den, which those lions should have eaten him. But yet, God protected him. God delivered him. And maybe we remember the backdrop to that story. But I want you to begin in verse 1 of Daniel, the 6th chapter, in which that chapter tells us of that event. We learn a little bit about Daniel. Daniel was a guy who had some power, and some real power. In verses 1 and 2, it seemed good to Darius, the king, to appoint 120 satraps, we'll just call them really important figures in the kingdom. The specifics here is not our emphasis, but they're very important. And they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, alright? And over these 120 men, there were 3 men who were over them. So they would be their managers, right? And Daniel was one of those 3. So he's in the upper management, right? And these men, these 120, they would be accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. They were the buffer between everyone else and the king. And Daniel himself, verse 3, he began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So of these 3 who were very important, Daniel is number 1, okay? Second in command in all of the world power of that day. But let's remember something else about Daniel. He was not a Babylonian by birth, was he? He was a young man who was taken captive from Judah, from Jerusalem. And now, as an old man, he has managed to basically become vice president because he was different than everyone else. The Lord was with him, as other chapters would tell us, chapters 1 and chapter 2. And he is there, and he is increasing. But as we pointed out on Wednesday night in our upstairs class in the book of Ecclesiastes, when one person works hard and they benefit from that, we find that their neighbor becomes jealous. And that is exactly what happens with all of these other leaders and these other rulers. They are are jealous of Daniel, not only probably because of his power, but because he's not one of them. He is a foreigner who has risen above them. He is different. And so verse 4, the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. They're looking for a way to get him. But they couldn't find it, right? They could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption. He was squeaky clean, we would say, in governmental affairs. We can't talk about any emails that he put on a separate server. There's nothing for him. It is just squeaky clean. But they've got to get him. Because there was no one who was as faithful. Because there was no negligence or corruption found in him. So what do they got to do? Verse 5. We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. The only thing we can find against him is that he worships his God. That is his only weakness, is his God. So notice what they do, verse 7. All the commissioners of the kingdoms, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, and the governors have consulted together. They go to the king after they have talked this over. They said, the only way we're going to get him is in this. And they say, king, this is what you do. Let no one make a petition, verse 7, to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days. And if they don't, or if they do, toss them in the den of lions. Now put yourself in that king's shoes for just one second. The guy in which you plan to appoint as your vice president, you do that because you trust him. You do that because you've seen the way he works. And these other people, you trust them as well. But they come and they butter you up. And you don't know that they've got malice in their heart. That they have envy in their heart. You just react to the fact, everyone is going to come to me. And everyone is going to be looking up to me. Not any of the other gods either, by the way. This was his 30 days. Someone came to you and said, everybody is going to follow you and you will be God for 30 days. People who have an ambitious mind be like, sign me up for that. And Darius said, go right ahead. Well, Daniel knows about it. So verse 8, the king signed it. And in verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he knew that his death sentence was waiting. What did he do? He entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open. And I'm going to emphasize this because we're going to come back to it in a second. Toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying, and here it is, and giving thanks. It is interesting to me that it specifies in this time of prayer, he gave thanks. Because I would have to ask myself the question, what in the world could Daniel be thankful for that day? He's not hiding what he is doing. And by the way, was there any law that said he had to pray 3 times a day? No, there was no law. There was custom of that. We would see that in the Psalms with David, that he would pray in the morning, in the noon, and in the evening. And we would see that in the New Testament. They would go to the temple to pray at the third hour, and so on and so forth, in the middle of the day, etc., etc. That was their custom. And Daniel didn't even have to do this. That's the point. But he still did it anyway. And in this, he gave thanks. Well, I would like to suggest he's got a couple of things to be thankful for just in that immediate context. He has something to be thankful for that he's about to rise to second in command. He has a lot of power. He started out as a captive, as a prisoner. Now he is over everyone. That's something to be thankful for, right? You would also say one of the things he could be thankful for is something that is not said by Daniel, but something that is said by David. And here's where I want to change gears for a second. I want you to go to the Psalms. I want you to go to Psalm chapter 35. This psalm is given of David, and many believe that David wrote this when Saul was chasing him and trying to kill him. And I wonder, as I look at several of the prophets, Jonah, Daniel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, if you read their prayers, many of them feel like psalms. And you can almost go back into the psalms and see a prayer or a song in which they sang, which expressed their feeling. Okay? And that's what the psalms are there for, in one sense. They are there to help us communicate to God our feelings. Because God has inspired men to write down certain feelings, to pray to Him, to speak to Him. And in Psalm, the 35th chapter, I wonder how many times Daniel had read this psalm. And finally, in Daniel 6, it rings true to him. Like he really feels this. And I want you to notice this in Psalm 35. Begin with me in verse 1. Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of the buckler and shield and rise up for my help. Draw also the spear and the battle axe to meet those who pursue me. What's he wanting God to do? Fight for him. God, you get up and you take it to them. And I want you to say to my soul, Lord, I am your salvation. I will save you. Is what God, tell me that you will save me. And so verse 4. Let those be ashamed and dishonored who seek my life. Let those be turned back and humiliated who devise evil against me. Could Daniel relate to that in any way? They have straight up devised evil to get him. It wasn't that he did anything wrong. They're looking to get him. God, fight for me. But I want you to notice how he wants it done. Let them be like chaff before the wind, with the angel of the Lord driving on. You take care of this. You do it. Not deliver them into my hand. And let their way, verse 6, be dark and slippery. Don't let them see where they're going and help them to fall down. 4, verse 7. Without cause, they hid their net for me, and without cause, they dug a pit for my soul. If they had just cause, David would have been saying, they've got a right to this. But they don't. They didn't have a right. He had done no wrong. Daniel could easily say, I've done no wrong. So what do I want to happen, verse 8? Let destruction come upon him unawares. Don't let him even know it's coming. You get him when he least expects it. And let the net which he hid catch himself. Turn it back on him. God, he's done this for me. Turn it back on him. And into that very destruction, let him fall. And isn't that what happens in our story of Daniel? They say, throw him in the pit. Throw him in the lion's den. He's tossed in. And he is delivered out. The king, who didn't want to do that to begin with, by the way. What's he do with those men? throws them into the lions. And before they even hit the ground, the text would tell us, they were devoured. I imagine Daniel could understand this psalm in a totally different way. Now notice the psalmist's reaction now. If you do that, if you get them, Lord, for what they are doing to me in the way in which they do it, in verse 9, my soul shall rejoice in the Lord, and it shall exult in His salvation. And all my bones will say, Lord, who is like you, who delivers the afflicted from him who is too strong for him, and the afflicted and the needy from whom robs him? Malicious witnesses rise up, and they ask me of things I do not know. They repay me evil for good to the bereavement of my soul. They're after me. I'll praise you if you do it. But here's where I want you to see how David treated them. Verse 13. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I mourned for them. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer kept returning to my bosom. I prayed for them. I fasted for them when things were not going well for them in their life. And here they are trying to kill me. What did I do to deserve that? So I went, verse 14, about as though it were my friend or brother. I bowed down mourning as one who sorrows for a mother. This wasn't just a fake pity. This was legitimate sorrow when things were going bad in their life. But verse 15, but at my stumbling, they rejoiced and gathered themselves together. The smiters whom I did not know gathered together against me, and they slandered me without cause. Isn't that what we saw in Daniel? They got together with no reason to get him. And so verse 16, like godless jesters at a feast, they are corrupt people. They gnashed at me with their teeth. Here's how we're going to get him. What did he have to be thankful for? Verse 17, here's what he had to be thankful for. Lord, how long will you look on? I want to suggest that one of the things he could be thankful for is that the Lord saw what they were doing. We don't often think about that. But I think about it in terms of sports for a second. An official, he misses a call. He missed it. You can't go back. You can't correct that. Now with the little video replay, you've got a little way of doing it. But once it's done and you missed it, it is missed. What does God not see? What does God not know? Nothing. He knows everything. He sees it. He knows what they're trying to do. And I'll tell you what, when there is somebody out there who is trying to get you, or there is somebody out there who hates you, God knows it. God sees it. And I can be thankful for that. Because there will be justice paid someday. And that's the question. How long will you look on? God, you see it. God, you know. When are you going to do something about it? And that's the way we usually feel. Do something about it. But be thankful that God actually sees it. So verse 17, Lord, how long will you look on? You know what I'm going through. Rescue my soul from their ravages. My only from the lions. That's an interesting thought there, isn't it? I don't know, David, remember he killed with his bare hands a lion and a bear. There were plenty of lions in those days. But what was Daniel tossed into? Den of lions. Deliver me from that. And verse 18, I will give thanks in the great congregation. I will let everybody know what you have done. And I will praise you among a mighty throng. I'm not keeping it to myself. So do not let those who are wrongfully my enemies rejoice over me. Nor let those who hate me without cause wink maliciously. For they do not speak peace, but they devise deceitful words against those who are quiet in the land. I'm not trying to harm anybody. So they opened wide their mouth against me and they said, aha, our eyes have seen it. Isn't that what happened? They set the trap. You got 30 days. You petitioned anyone else. All they had to do was walk by Daniel's house. Windows were wide open. Aha! We see him. And they go to the king. We found him. We called him. And he's saying, let me out. So verse 22, you have seen it, O Lord. Don't keep silent. O Lord, do not be far from me. Stir up yourself and awake to my right, my justice, and to my cause, my God and my Lord. Judge me, O Lord, my God, according to your righteousness, and do not let them rejoice over me. God, stand up for me. Judge it. So don't let them say, aha, our desire. And do not let them say, we swallowed him up. We got him. But let those be ashamed and humiliated together, all together, who rejoice at my distress. And let them be clothed with shame and dishonor, who magnify themselves over me. Daniel could have felt that. So verse 27, as it closes out, let them shout for joy and rejoice, those who favor my vindication. For the righteous out there, let them shout. Let them rejoice because you came and you delivered me. Let the Lord be magnified, who delights in the prosperity of His servant. And my tongue shall declare your righteousness, your praise, all day long. I wonder if Daniel knew that he was going to get out of that lion's den. My guess is he didn't know. My guess is he was like his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who said, our God will deliver us. We don't know if we're going to die, but we know not only He has the power, but He will. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm Daniel, what do I have to be thankful for when I've got everybody against me like that? God knows. God's got it. God will deliver. Now here's the second aspect I want you to think about when we think about Daniel and another psalm. Why don't you go over to Psalm 137. Again, another psalm that is not credited to Daniel. It's credited by some by Jeremiah. But it is written at a time of the Babylonian captivity, the same time that Daniel would have been alive. And Jeremiah was never in Babylonian captivity. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that Jeremiah would have written this psalm, given that verse 1, he says, by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Jeremiah, we have no record of him being in Babylon. Okay? So who wrote this psalm? I do not know. But it is from the feeling of those who were captive in Babylon. And Daniel would have felt that, wouldn't he? I want you to remember one more thing, right? When things are going bad in our life, one of the things that we find it easy to be thankful for is our family, is our children, right? Remember Daniel's situation? He was a eunuch. He was made a eunuch. Meaning, he has no wife, and he has zero ability to have any children. What does he have to be thankful for? Oh, wait, just one second. He's in his homeland. Everything is great. He's got all his friends from back home. He can just go home around the corner to the old neighborhood bar and grill to where he hangs out with everybody. He's got nobody. He is in a foreign land. And that is the way that these people felt. I'm not living in my house. This is some other land. This is some other house. And the people would have truly felt that way. We're captive. And if you've ever felt you couldn't get out of something, and you're stuck in something, that's a terrific feeling, right? No. You've got to find some reason to be thankful for being stuck. So notice Psalm 137. So by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept. When did they weep? And what did they cry about? When we remembered Zion. When they thought about their hometown, when they thought about their capital city in which the name of God was chosen to dwell there forever, and they think about that beautiful temple covered in gold and the beautiful worship that was offered there, and they look and we're here. They weep. And they cry. And verse 2, upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. We hung up our musical instruments. And these are the musical instruments apparently that were done for the joy and the recreation of, like, we play music to feel good. They sat theirs down because of their weeping. And why did they do that? For our captors demanded of us songs. The Babylonians, those who took them captive, are saying, you play for us. Or we might say, dance, monkey, dance. And they're saying, how can we dance? How can we do this? How can we sing us a song of Zion? We're not in Zion. We're crying about Zion. How can we do that? How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land, in a foreign land? It's not the same. You ever felt that way? Homesick? What in the world can you be thankful for when that's going on? They're trying to get you. You're homesick. And notice what they sing. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. What did you say? If I ever forget where I came from, and I forget about that great city of the great King, Jesus would say, may my hand that plays that instrument, may it not be able to play the instrument again. May it lose its skill. So verse 6. So may my tongue cling on the roof of my mouth. May I not be able to speak. May I not be able to sing if I do not remember you. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. You have to find a way to be thankful when you're in this foreign land. And then where did Daniel pray towards, by the way? Towards Jerusalem. Because that was his hometown? Probably not. But because that was the city in which his God chose to put his name. And if I don't remember that place, and if I don't think about that place when I'm out here in this captivity, may I never be able to find joy again. Find it, he says. But notice how the psalm turns. I've got to find the joy, okay? But verse 7, Babylon, you've got to deal with taking us captive. So remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its very foundation. What did the people want to do with this city? Burn it to the ground. And what did Babylon do? Burned it to the ground. And some of the people saw it, but some of these people who were sitting by the river weeping, they may have never even seen it. They may have been born in that strange land. But yet they need to remember it. The people that wanted it leveled to the ground and burned down. This is what's going to happen to them, verse 8. O daughter of Babylon, you devastated one. It's coming to you. You devastated Jerusalem. You will be destroyed. You will be devastated. And how blessed will be the one who repays you. You did it. Man, how happy is that man who gets to come back on you? Because with recompense with which you have repaid us, that net that you laid, it is there for you. Then here's the bleak part, verse 9. How blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock. You know what makes me happy? When justice is paid. But doesn't it seem a little cold that you would do that to the little ones? To the children of Babylon? What did the kids ever do? What did they ever do to you? Well, I've thought about this, and I may be wrong about this. What's the best thing that could happen for a little child who grows up in a pagan society where you worship a big golden statue that is 90 feet tall, and you only petition a man for 30 days, and you don't worship the true God, and you grow up in that, and you're raised in that? What is the best thing that could possibly happen to that child? Something kind of ferocious. Something that we would call sickening and disheartening. That child would be taken home, having never to make those decisions. And I wonder sometimes if that's what the Lord was doing when He would go in to, say, the Amalekites and tell Saul, wipe them out. Men, women, and children. Babylon, go in, wipe them out. Men, women, and children. If it wasn't mercy, rather than it was cruelty. And I don't know the answer to that question. And I don't know what they mean, because it sure sounds to me, when you dash somebody against a rock, that is one painful way to take somebody out. And I should have looked up the word here, if the little ones is like a kid, or if the little ones is just like young adults. Not sure. Michael might know that off the top of his head. I don't know. But why can he take joy in that? Why does he say, blessed is the one who does that? Because wickedness must be paid for. Justice must be served. And when that day comes, and we all have to stand before the one who saw it all, and we have to be judged, the one, as the New Testament says, who is ready to judge the living and the dead, we'll have to answer for that. And justice will be paid. And if I have been wronged in my life, I can be thankful that God will take care of that. And I can be unthankful if I have wronged Him or I have wronged others, that justice will also be paid, because I will be one of these who is dashed against the rock, one of these who is trapped by his own snares. So when Daniel was giving thanks that day, I wonder if he thought about the demise of all of these people he was working with, and all these people he was making plans with, or if he was truly sorrowful that it would happen to them. I don't know. But he gave thanks to God for something, even when people were trying to take his life. What can you find to be thankful for today? There's always something out there. Subject to the invitation in any way. We ask that you come now. We stand and ask.